My name's Steve Gallimore. I moved to Herefordshire in January 1976, so I'm a blow-in very much. Been here ever since. Living in Leominster since November 83. What's that? 42 years now, this coming up. I was born in July 1952. At the time, my parents were living in Manchester. They were both born and brought up in Manchester. That's where they were from. And we moved to Horwich, a little town just outside Bolton, again in Lancashire. We moved there in about 54, I think it was. Dad worked with... He was a... And I laugh about Keir Starmer now, because he always says, my father was a toolmaker. My father was a toolmaker, you know. And he'd worked and served his apprenticeship at Metros, the aircraft factory. So he was born, what, 1920? So at the start of the Second War, he was still going through his apprenticeship. He'd have been 19 at the time. He and all his mates were desperate to sign up, wanted to serve, wanted to be in the forces. They went from recruiting station to recruiting station, and each time they were turned away saying, no, your job's more important. You're actually building aircraft, which is far more important. Sadly, I think he carried that as almost a stigma for the rest of his life, that he'd had a reserved occupation and hadn't joined up with all the others. Probably saved his life, but there we go. And probably a more effective use of him as an individual. So there he was in Metros. He's met Mum. I never really did find out how Mum and Dad met, but there we are, they've met. I think initially, after they were married, they lived with his parents, with Nan and Grandad. And then De Havilland's aircraft factory had set up in Lostock, just outside Horwich. And I think they'd come to some sort of deal with the local authority about... if the local authority provide council housing, they would expand the factory with more jobs, and that's what happened. So I think there was quite a wave of youngsters from Metros transferred to De Havilland's and moved on to the council estate. So there was quite a few people there that all knew each other before they moved. And at the time, as a kid, you're just growing up and you think, this is my normal world. I just grow up in this world, and you don't give any thought to it. But looking back, you can imagine that it's almost a bit like a bit of social engineering, that you've transplanted this group of Mancunians to Horwich outside Bolton. And they've all gone into the estate. They all knew one another from beforehand. They're all youngsters together, so they're all getting young families together. So it's sort of this cohort coming through. And stayed there for, what were we on the estate till? From 54 to... late 60s, 68, something like that. Yeah, it would have been somewhere around there. And then they moved to another council house, the other side of Horwich, and much nearer work. Dad could actually walk to work from where we were now. Horwich, it's the hometown. It's all I ever knew growing up. I don't ever have any recollections of Manchester at all. Population of about 15,000 it would have been in the early 50s, so not that much different to Leominster as we are at present, you know, so similar sort of size. Everything was done on public transport, buses everywhere and trains. Horwich was a train town. It was a big engineering works in Horwich. So they did a lot of actual initially train building from there for the Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway. That's where it was, and then it became integrated into British Rail and what have you. I think by the early 80s, because originally, initially it was still be steam, but it had then gone to diesel, and British Rail wasn't building as many, so it was a question of toss-up. Do we keep Horwich? Do we keep Crewe? I think there's only ever going to be one answer to that, and it wasn't Horwich. So yeah, there's quite a few blokes twiddling their thumbs then in the area. And I'd probably left by then. Yes, I would have done. Went down to college in Aber in 71. So yeah. It was still home at the time, but it was very, very much a distant one. Family-wise, just the one sister, Janet. She's 6 years younger than me, so growing up as a kid, that's a huge distance, isn't it? Whatever school you're just leaving, they're just joining. So, it's always this tiny dot. So I was born in 1952. Mum and Dad from Manchester. I think that they were married 1947, 1948, and then they moved eventually to Horwich. I think there might have been a bit of family friction involved there, because after the marriage, I think Mum and Dad lived with his parents, and I know over the years afterwards, whenever we were visiting Nan and Grandad in Manchester, Dad and I would go, but Mum and my sister Janet, there was always a reason why they weren't going, and I never followed up on that, but I suspect there was a bit of friction between Mum and Grandad in particular. So and as a kid, you just accept these things, don't you? And you don't dig into it. Or I was sufficiently naive and not to keep saying, "Well, why are you not coming, Mum?" You know, it was, but it's just the way it was. So I didn't see much of Nan and Grandad. By the time I started to know them, so you're into a kid of, I don't know, six or seven, something like that. Nan had had a stroke by that time, so she was bedbound, affected her speech. So you can imagine, as a kid, going to visit infrequently and finding this woman in the bed in the front room and everybody having to interpret for her, and it's not very comfortable. And Grandad was still part of very much of a drinking culture, so every evening they put her in the wheelchair, and Auntie Elsie and Uncle Norman lived with them permanently. And Elsie was one of the, you know, that cohort of daughters who stayed at home to look after Mum and Dad. Well, particularly so with Nan, because she needed nursing effectively all the time. So the four of them would all toddle off to the pub and every evening, and that was the way it was. My grandfather, George, I think he was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was a George. I think he was into the... If you're doing your family tree now, a lot of people say, "Oh, all I've got is agricultural labourers in my family tree." Well, I think Grandad would have fallen into that category. But they lived in a very large house on the edge of one of Manchester's large cemeteries. And I think, amongst other things, he was gardener, greenkeeper, probably gravedigger as well for it. For one part of my knowledge of it. And then for another part, they were in another large house on the edge of this large space. And I think he was something to do with ground maintenance at the local water treatment works, which sort of circles back into my working life later on. Didn't give it a second thought at the time. The family originally were from Cheshire, perhaps, and I've got Nantwich in my mind, that they came up from there. And I think it was Grandad who's moved up to Manchester and then set up his family there. So you got this progression north from Nantwich to Manchester and then Manchester to Horwich. That's probably as far north as we went. I came south after that, came to Herefordshire. So yeah, not a lot of contact with Nan and Grandad over the years. Grandad had a big bristly white moustache and a big shock of white hair. And of course, grandparents, when you're little, you know, they're all big people, aren't they? You know, they're all adults are big. And so I've not got a feeling for how tall he was, whether he was a tall man or a short man. Dad was tall. He would have been 5'11", 6 foot, something like that. So I don't think, yeah, he's probably a similar sort. No matter how much my mum fed him, my dad was always thin as a rake, or thin as a lat, they used to say. Granddad was a bulkier bloke. Mind you, if he's digging and doing lots of manual labour around about, then as opposed to the toolmaker who was going around setting up the different machines, then you know, perhaps that was part of it. But Gran, she was a figure in the bed or a figure in the wheelchair. So I've got no measure as to whether she was tall, she was bedbound, but not particularly large, so on the thinner side. But that's the memory of them, really. On mother's side, I never knew my maternal grandfather. He died, I don't think he died that long after mum and dad had got married, so he must be late 40s, early 50s. I never met him. But he'd been unable to serve, I'm going to say, in either war. I don't know when he was born. But if the other granddad was born around 1900, it would have been touch and go as to whether they were old enough to get into the First War. Grandad Gallimore was in the First War. He was. So he must have been earlier. He must have been something like 1890 then, because he served at Gallipoli and was wounded and came home and didn't serve again with the Manchesters. But Grandad Taylor, I think, had a very weak heart, so was not, you know, as soon as they examined him, he was not even considered fit for service. So I think he worked at a hospital for most of his life. And Nana Taylor was still a machinist, as in a sewing machinist, and worked in various places around Manchester for all my childhood until probably my late teens before she retired. And she lived in Cheetham Hill in Manchester, Blakely and then Cheetham Hill, because we used to get off the bus at Blakely office was where you had to get off if you were going to, and then Cheetham Hill was not far away from there, if I'm right. My geography of Manchester is not great. It's and then in later years she moved out to Glossop in Derbyshire, where my mum's younger brother lived with his family. So Bob was, you very much think, Grandad's afterthought. He's only probably something like 10 years older than I am. So growing up, mum would go back and see her mum quite frequently, and we would all go. So Bob was very much like the elder brother I never had. And then once he'd got transport, because he was very much into motorbikes and what have you to start with, he'd come over and see his sister in Horwich a lot, and then he'd be into cars and coming over. So he had a whole sequence of his girlfriends coming over. You know, he'd be fetching them over. And I'd be opening the front door and saying, "Oh, it's Bob with another one." It's, yeah. So he and his wife Brenda now have moved to Spain and have been there for the last 15 years, 20 years and more now. So the family disperse. Bob had two daughters, one who's married an Australian and now lives in Australia, and the other actually lives in Wrexham, which is another link back, because that's where my wife Jan comes from. He was christened Robert Ian, and for some reason my mum called him Robin. So we always knew him as Robin growing up. And it's only sort of when you got older that you realised that it's actually Bob or Rob, and you know, so he's reverted to that very much in later life. You know, so yeah, I'll call him Bob now rather than Robin. You know, so I don't know whether he particularly liked being called Robin, but it's one of these labels you get lumbered with as a kid growing up, isn't it? Mum had a slightly younger brother, Jack. Whilst we were growing up, he married a nurse during the war. She was from Paignton in Devon, and after the war went back there. She was nursing in Paignton or Torquay, whatever the hospital is around there. And so we went a couple of times to see them. Long way from Horwich. Virtually a day's journey on the train, so didn't happen very often. And I probably saw Jack half a dozen times during my lifetime. And then he died, 1990, something like that. So not a guy I ever really got to know. So that was the two brothers on Mum's side. Dad had three sisters. Hilda was the eldest, Elsie, and then Doris was the youngest, and he got one younger brother, George, as well. He seemed to go through phases with them, so there'd be times when we'd see Hilda and her family, and Hilda had three daughters, one the same age as me and a few years older. Sadly, they all died very young, so I don't know whether there was some family congenital illness that they'd all contracted. Elsie stayed at home looking after Nan, never had any children. And then there was Doris, who married Alan. They had a couple of boys, Keith and Neil. So we were closely in touch with them for quite a while. Dad died quite young. Dad died at 60. So Dad died 1981. Yeah, February 81. And again, you get the family issues that once Dad had died, there was no connection with the others, and so Mum was not in touch with them. So over the years, I'd be saying, and how are we getting on with, oh, I'm sorry, but I had a card to say she died last month, or and then somebody else had died. And I said, well, if you'd let me know, I would have been keen to go to the funeral, you know, but it was always a bit late. And it was happening when that stage where, you know, we've moved south, we've got a young family, and it's no excuse. I should have been more diligent in chasing them up and saying, I'm sorry it's so long after the event, but here I am at least to talk to you if there's nobody else. There it is, such is life. Schooling, everybody from the estate went down to Lord Street Infant School. You know, it was just, that's where you went, boom. I can recall one incident that stuck with me over all the years. When you were learning to read, and I can visualise this large sacking unit which was hung on the wall. Within the sacks there were pockets, and in each of the pockets were reading cards, and they'd probably be perhaps A5 size, something like that, with big print on them. So it wasn't difficult to read, and there wasn't a lot to read, and it would be 1A, 1B, 1C in the pockets, and you get to the end of the row, and then you went on to 2 and work. And you had to practice reading it at your desk, and then you had to take it out to the teacher and read it. And the whole class would work through this. And then obviously some people were faster than others, and they'd get through 3 and 4 cards, and then I've gone to put my card in and take the next one out, and there aren't any in the next one. I'm guessing because other folk have got them all, you know. So I've gone off to the front, said, please, miss. And she gives me a book, and I look at it and I say, but I can't read that because it's in a book. I can read cards, but I can't read a book. And she got the previous card out and turned back a couple of pages in the book and said, well, read me the card. Oh, I read the card, that was easy. And then she's passed me the book, which of course has got exactly the same words in it that I've just read out from the card. And, you know, the light bulb moment goes on that there's nothing magic about reading a book. And, whoa, I was made up after that. I can read books now. So I never had to go back to the sacking to take a card out of the sack again. So that was the infant school, and there would have been a junior school sort of attached to it. But Mum had got her eyes on other things, and there was a church school, not as near, it was further away actually. So she got me shifted to the junior school. And you just accept that's fine, that's what Mum wants. It's what Mum wants, that's what we're doing, you know. So that was a great time. Horwich Old Boys, it had been there something like 1770. But it was split. The boys' junior school at the top of the hill, parish church in the middle, girls' junior school at the bottom of the hill. So I was there for whatever the 4 or 5 years were. Headmaster was Ronald Sutcliffe. He was also the opening quick bowler for Horwich Railway Mechanics Institute cricket team, and a very good quick bowler as well. So this would have been in the Bolton League. It would have been like having... if it was in Leinster, you'd have had, let's use Hereford as another alternative. So you'd have had a Whitecross team, and you'd have had a Tupsley team and a Bartersley team and what have you. Well, it was the same round Bolton, and Horwich was one of them. And the next step up from there would have been the Lancashire League. And the Lancashire League at the time was fetching a lot of particularly West Indian internationals to play in the Lancashire League. So the one story I can remember was not only did they have the league, but they had a knockout cup as well, which went on every year. And two teams had got to the final, and it might have been Walkden versus Farnworth. And each team had a nominal professional. He might have been somebody who played once for Leicester Seconds or something like that. But I think it was Farnworth, the professional, had been injured in the semi-final. So the committee had a meeting and went to the Hamer Cup competition committee and said, we think we will be quite significantly disadvantaged because we've not got our professional, he was injured. Would you mind awfully if we engaged another professional for the final? So heads were put together, and yes, this seems fair. So the Farnworth were allowed to go and hire another professional. At the time, Charlie Griffiths was the fast bowler who was the West Indies international team fast bowler, terrorising batsmen all over the world, and he was playing in the Lancashire League. So they hired him for the evening to come and play in the Hamer Cup. And I think he took 9 wickets. It was, I remember watching it. He was setting off from the bottom of the pavilion steps with a big jump and off to bowl. And yes, it was a bit one-sided, sadly. Went through the... church school there in Horwich, and then past the 11 plus. So I imagined I'd just go off to the local grammar school, which was just up the road from where we were at the time. Very close, in fact. It was closer to walk to the grammar school than it was to walk to the junior school. But Mum had got another idea, and there was a church grammar school in Bolton. And that was supposed to be a cut above the local one. So that's where I was going. So from there, it was a bus to Bolton every morning, and then a bus out of Bolton to the grammar school, and then back again in the evening. And in fact, on some mornings, when I go to get the bus at the end of the road, I'd be getting on the bus that Dad would be getting off, having done a night shift. So, you know, we'd have a couple of minutes, because it was the terminus, we'd have a couple of minutes chatting before he walked home and the bus went off on its way. Yeah, so that was whatever, through school. Looking back, was I better off there than going to the local school? Certainly lost a lot of friends locally, and the friends that you made at Cannon Slade School in Bolton, they were from all over South Lancashire and Bolton and up onto the moors and what have you. So I've not kept in touch with any of them geographically. They were all over the show. So you're picking up from this that Mum was really committed to education for us, and she kept her eyes open, and this was the way to go. I guess if you ask any parent, had they done their best for their kid, then you would say, well, what more could you ask? And she had, so, you know, well done her. I got a scholarship to the grammar school. I don't know why, because I didn't ever sit an exam to go there. So I've got a feeling that because this place took pupils from quite a geographical area, I think various education authorities had numbers allocated. So Bolton itself would have had so many, Lancashire Education might have had some, you know, Oldham might have had, Rochdale, you know, this place like that. So I rather suspect that I've just fallen lucky in that Lancashire not only had spare places, but they also had a scholarship place which nobody else was taking up. And they've sort of looked at my 11 plus and said, well, all right, then he can have it. So there we are. Were we a religious family? Certainly once we were going to the church school, we became far more involved in the church. And I sang in the choir with the church. So went to Sunday school. So you were morning service, Sunday school in the afternoon, evening service afterwards. So Sunday was a lot of backwards and forwards. And as I suggested before, the church sat between the boys' school at the top of the hill and the girls' school at the bottom of the hill. So, and the Cubs and Scouts met in the boys' school hall. So when you were there on a Friday night and a Thursday night and whatever. So the amount of backing and toing to the up and down there, I must have worn a groove. It's what was I like as a kid? It varies in different times. So when I was in junior school, and I was still in touch with the guys on the estate then, because we were still in Horwich, so you still came across them. So you'd still go down to the football pitch and everybody kicking round and what have you. Moving on to the grammar school at 11, so it's before you've you develop in any sort of really separate social life in that sense. So I was losing contact with the guys around. Didn't do as much football. For a while, did quite a lot of fishing, which is quite solitary. You know, you'd sit on the edge of the mill pond and be watching this float, which never actually moved. It was probably not the greatest fisherman. So did that for a while. Towards the end of the senior school, did a lot of hill walking. Came across a rock climbing course which the local authority were running. So that was good. Locally, around Horwich and on the hills above Bolton as well, there were quite a few very small quarries where they'd won the stone from the quarry, but it was not brilliant stone, so they were not brilliant quarries, and most of them were probably only something like 20 or 30 foot high. So you could climb those almost without a rope, if you were. But from the climbing course, then there was a rock climbing group in Bolton, so you got associated with them, and you'd be off to North Wales. I don't know quite how I persuaded even Mum, as though she was keen for me with her education, that it was the best thing to do to go on a weekend's climbing before my A levels on Monday morning. You know. But I was obviously sufficiently persuasive that she accepted it. And there's a fond memory, because that was a lovely walk up Trevan in North Wales, and then climbing the last bit and sitting on the top as the sun was setting coming down the valley. Lovely memory of that. And the day afterwards, they're saying, yeah, it's going to be a bit different today. So we're not that far from the era when, remember, people like Joe Brown were doing rock climbing, and Dan Willans and what have you. And some of these guys from Manchester, really, particularly ones from South Manchester, could get on their motorbike and get into North Wales to do their climbing, and then were doing enough climbing. They were writing articles. Then they'd set up a little shop in somewhere like Clanberris where they could sell climbing kit. So lo and behold, they could actually live there all week and do the climbing. So they were putting up some of these famous routes, that things like up on Clanberris. And of course, they've got to be dramatic names, something like Cemetery Gates or Cenotaph Corner was, you know. The thing with them was you started off from the road at the bottom, and probably 80% of it is just walking up the scree slope. It's, you're not climbing, you're scrambling a bit. But by the time you get to the bottom of the climb, you turn round and you look down and you're thinking, oh, my God. And I just couldn't cope with the height. I've been used to all this stuff in quarries in Bolton where you're about 30 foot off the floor, you know. And again, this thing was not going to be much more than, I don't know, it might have been 50, it might have been 60, but it was nothing ridiculous. You weren't climbing thousands of feet, but you were hundreds of feet above the ground. No, I just froze. I couldn't cope with any of it. So that was probably the end of my rock climbing after that. So no thanks. It's I found my limit and I'm happy with it. So, yeah, the climbing club was called the Adventure Club, and they would do canoeing. They would do lots of hill walking. They'd do rock climbing, anything that would get you out of doors and doing something physical, really. And we've been off to the Lake District with them, and where the scree slopes aren't us, and I could still do the climbs there. I was all right with that. And I think you look back on it and you look at it now. I mean, coincidentally, my grandson, who's now 15, Tom, he's really into his climbing. But these days you do it all in a big metal shed on a climbing wall, where you're not bothered about the rain or, you know, is it hot or cold? Or, oh, it's not. It's whatever it is. And when I finish this, I'll go and get a coffee over there and we'll sit and have a minute, and then I'll go up another one. And you do it all indoors, and the more you look at it, the more you realise it's actually a gymnastic exercise. And I was never going to be a gymnast, was I? So, So, you know, I'm pretty sure it would have come to an end even if I hadn't had the height issues with the height of the scree at Cenotaph Corner there. So, yeah. So let's talk about the council estate then. Brand new, post-war. They've moved this whole cohort of new employees into De Havilland's, and they weren't just coming from metros. I mean, a chunk of them were who knew one another, so they were. But I'm sure they've come from other places as well. They're all youngsters, young marrieds together. So mum and dad have turned up with me, so and lots of others. Kids would have a similar age, so they've all turned up at the same time. Indoor bathroom. So I can see why mum and dad would have been happier there than living with nan and grandad, where there's a friction. And I can recall on my maternal grandma's side, whenever we would go to visit, the loo was at the bottom of the yard. Nice square slice pieces of newspaper on a nail on the side, and you know, I don't think there was no light in there, so you took a torch with you when you went down the yard in the winter. So having an indoor bathroom was, you're thinking, well, they must have been really made up. I can order it. The rent man used to come round. Was it a Thursday morning? Had a huge, big leather satchel that, and he'd present the rent book and the rent, and he'd sign it off. And mum was always chirpy on a rent day morning because she was paying her rent, and it meant she could be there for another week, and that was her, and that was how it was. And you think, well, you're just organised, aren't you? But no, for her, it was quite a milestone in her week that she was always she was paying her rent on time. And the Mr. Stubbs, the rent man, gosh, haven't thought of his name in 60 odd years now. And talking of a rent man, here's another little thing. Years later, I was talking about L.S. Lowry, the artist. And I was talking with mum and just saying, I was quite impressed with some of the pieces he'd done. And she said, a very funny man. I said, so you knew him? Oh, yeah, he was the rent collector. Used to come round with a big leather satchel. And, he'd collect the rent from us. Always had a very big, nasty dog with him. So I don't know whether that was for dealing with people who weren't paying their rent, or for people who might think he was worth knocking on the back of the head and running off with his satchel. But, very funny man was L.S. Lowry, according to mum, you know. So most of Horwich is built on the side of the hill, and it's the foothills of the Pennines, really. You go back beyond Horwich and they just get higher and higher, and then you've got the spine running up the centre of Britain. People driving north on the M61 out of Manchester will go past Horwich. Bolton Wanderers, when I was a lad growing up, they played at Burndon Park, which was just off the town centre in Bolton. And in the late 80s, I think it was, like many of these clubs now, they've built themselves a new stadium. And they actually built theirs in Horwich on the Middlebrook estate. So you see it as you're going up the M61, if you're heading north towards Preston, the Lake District, Scotland, whatever. As you're going along, you'll see the you'll see Bolton Wanderers football ground there. But going back to the and when mum and dad moved from the first council house to the second one in the late 60s, they were very much at that end of town. So the if you were to come off the motorway and drive towards Horwich, you would have the football stadium on your left-hand side and the what had been de Havilland's factory. Then it became Hawker Siddeley, then it was and it's currently still British Aerospace, or a branch of British Aerospace, is on the right-hand side. So you got one on the one on the other, and the town very much in front of you with where we lived. Going back to the first estate on Ormston Avenue, very much on this steep slope. When kids were riding their bikes, being able to get up the hill to us, that was the mark that you were now able to ride your bike, that you could ride it to the top of the hill to get there. Going down was fun, you know. And when we've moved there, so it's post-war, nobody's got any money, cars aren't being built because the economy was pushing it into commercial vehicles at the time. And that's the story why Land Rover built Land Rovers, because they could argue that it was an agricultural vehicle rather than a retail vehicle for the population. So cars weren't around. So playing on the estates, you just played across all the roads because there were so few cars. And because all these kids grew up together, your cricket team that played was always the same age, you know, growing together, with a couple of younger brothers and sisters, you know, coming in as well. I remember the winter of 1963, which was a really cold, long winter. And it had snowed early, and so you'd all got your sledges out to go down this hill. And at the bottom of the hill, there was a wall which must have stood, I don't know, perhaps 3-4 feet high, something like that. So when you got to the bottom, there's no chance of stopping. You just dropped off the wall and across the road. well, fortunately, it was so cold and so icy that people weren't moving their cars round, and all the sledges were just going straight across the road. They were not stopping until they hit the pavement on the other side, and often it would be the hedge on the other side when you sort of did this dramatic slalom to get into the into the hedge sideways. And that carried on for 3 months, perhaps longer. And the ice and the snow was there. It was a real good long winter. When it was worth having a sledge and you could go out on a daily basis, several times a day. It was
Well, so was it a happy childhood for you, or was there ups and downs?
Was it a happy childhood? I think so. And I think with hindsight, I'm probably thinking I was happier than I probably appreciated at the time. What I hadn't understood until much later, we talked about earlier about my sister Janet being 6 years younger than me. She was delivered in a local maternity home, I think they call them, at the maternity home, big house on the road into Bolton. But not long after that, Mum was diagnosed with breast cancer, I wouldn't have been much more than 6 or 7 at the time, something like that, and it's not anything that Mum and Dad really talked to me about. So in the background of me going on with ordinary everyday life, Mum had to go into hospital for a while, so she had surgery, breast removed, and various other bits of treatment. Nana Taylor came and looked after us. That was funny for a while. And then what I hadn't appreciated was, from Leinster, historically, you would have, for cancer treatment, you would have gone to Cheltenham. Well, in Manchester or Bolton or Horwich, you went to Christie's in Manchester. So what I hadn't appreciated was that Mum was packing me off to school. One of the neighbours was having Janet as a baby to look after. And then she was jumping on the bus to Christie's to have her chemotherapy, to turn round and get the bus back from Manchester in time to be home for when I've got back. Bouncing in through the door. Right, Mum, where's me tea then? You know, her poor dad is still trying to get to grips with the chemotherapy she's had that morning. And I'm telling me, well, I'm not feeling very bright just at present. Do you mind if I have a sit down for a while? And if you must, you know, but didn't get a lot of sympathy from me for that. You know, so, oh, dear, dear. So some funny things went on at that time. So there was the couple who lived next door. Ashton, were they? Ashton, I think they were called. And the bloke delivered paraffin. So he drove this big van, which had a tank in the back. And he would go around selling paraffin, because you were in the era where you still had paraffin stoves. And we had a paraffin stove at home, because it was not central heating. It was still a coal-fired place. And that was fine where you got a coal fire in the front, but in the back of the kitchen, it was getting a bit chilly in there. So we had a paraffin heater. So there were times during the summer when they'd say, Mr. Ashton's offered to take you out on the van today. And you think, oh, all right, he's not the most communicative of blokes, but yeah, okay, I'll go. And it was just palming me off whilst Mum was going off for her treatment. And he, poor dab, was lumbered with this 7-year-old who's not exactly best impressed with him, you know. But I became quite a dab hand at filling the paraffin cans for people after a few days. So, and you look back on it, you think, well, yeah, that makes sense now. But at the time, it was all just a bit, well, all right, but why? It's, yeah.